We are still finishing up some here on lesson three, actually the page six of lesson three. We've still got some comments to make there, and then we'll kind of work our way into the next lesson. So what we have seen as Nehemiah has come into the city of Jerusalem was that he spent a little bit of time just waiting, looking around the city, investigating what needed to be done in the city. And the walls of the city were all still destroyed. They were all on the ground. Nothing, it seems as though nothing had been done. And we talked some just about his methodology here. The fact that he didn't just kind of blast in the town and start giving orders to everybody, and about how that probably would not have worked just all so well had he done that. And so we've seen the wisdom in surveying the situation and thinking about what it needed to be done, and being able to make an assessment then of the work that was before them. On page six, where we were kind of making some practical applications, so to speak, of what Nehemiah did and his approach, a very balanced approach is something we were talking about last time when our time came to an end. The fact that Nehemiah has demonstrated this before when he came before the king, remember? It was some time, 4 months, that he mourned and fasted and prayed before he stood before the king. And when he came before the king, he was ready to say what needed to be said, and said it in such a way that it made sense, and the king was receptive and responsive to that. And that he had taken some time to think and to pray and to get his thoughts together. And so when Nehemiah came into town in Jerusalem, it was kind of the same thought again. He took some time to survey the situation and think about this. There was no doubt that the city was still in shambles, that it was a mess. Would have been pretty easy to point that out, but that's just pointing out the obvious, isn't it? And it's not that there was a city without leadership. There was. There was leadership there. There were officers, there were nobles in whatever capacity that might be. And there were those in some of the outlying areas of the city that were leaders. So it's not that there was no one who was designated as leaders, but the leadership, as far as the city goes, was inept as far as trying to get anything done. It had been years now, years that some had come back to Jerusalem after the captivity, and yet there's been little done to the walls, if anything, to the walls of the city. And so what we were talking about as our class came to a close last time was the fact that how you go about saying some things is very important. And we see that with Nehemiah in the fact that he was able to measure what he had to say. And what he said made sense, and it got support. There was balanced leadership is the term that I think we were using. In Proverbs, Solomon says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. I don't know exactly what Nehemiah said to the people in the city, but it resulted in a positive response. Sometimes it's not just what you have to say, it's how you say it that has all the difference in the world with the kind of response that's going to come from that. As we look at the latter part here of chapter 2, you know, about the middle of the page of our worksheet here, Nehemiah did not jump to any hasty conclusions. You know, that first he gathered some information. I mean, he had heard about the situation of the city, hadn't he? I mean, he already knew it was in shambles. He'd been told the people were in disgrace. But he didn't come into town just, you know, screaming to everybody, look at this mess. Why aren't you doing anything? But instead, he took some time to make his way around the city and to look firsthand. I mean, think about this in a practical way. I mean, if you are responsible to make a report to somebody and try to come to some kind of a plan of action, and you've heard from some other people about, here's the situation, you know, we got to get this fixed. But now you are the one to go to, if it's in a work situation or school situation, you are the one to go to some other folks and say, okay, look, this is the situation there. It's really bad, and we got to get something done. But you haven't been there, and you haven't looked at or assessed the situation. I mean, how much influence do you have with those that you are trying to move in a certain direction? Well, pretty limited, isn't it? And I mean, again, going back to the point, what if Nehemiah had just kind of blown into town and said, I've heard about the mess here and how bad it is and nobody's doing anything? We got to get this job done. How well would that have worked? I mean, there's a lot of applications we can make to that, whether it's going to be in the home, community situations, or in work situations, or in the church. We can make application about looking at some things firsthand and making some reasonable assessment of a situation before we try to effect any change. Now, what are you thinking about? What points would you make with that? Been gone for so long.
Yeah.
And like with Nehemiah, we don't know that he'd ever even been to Jerusalem before. Likely had not been. Likely had been born during captivity. And so it's sort of like, can you imagine him coming to town and someone saying, "Who do you think you are? You want to come here and tell us what we need? Who are you?" Can you imagine that? And we can see applications we can make in other aspects of life with that, can't we? Okay. What other points can we make with this? The fact that Nehemiah comes into town and for 3 days doesn't say anything.
I think, if he would have come into town, as you said he could have, he may have still got the job done. But I think from his prayer, one of the things that he wanted was he wanted the people to want to do what needed to be done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, well, what he could have come into town and said, I've got these letters here from the king. Remember how he had asked for letters to help him get through the region of the Trans-Euphrates and things like that? I mean, what about in a work environment when the boss comes in and says, okay, I want you to do this and you do that and you do that, and then the boss is gone, never to be seen again? You still do your work? Well, yeah, I hope so. That's your job, okay? But your attitude about it might be a whole lot different than when a leader uses a different approach. What about in the home? Can we make some application with that in the home? Leadership in the home? You know, it's easy sometimes, for the husband, for the father to come in and just kind of spout out orders. Here's how we're going to do it. You know, it doesn't always work real well. As trying to solicit some support and give some reason even for, look, here's what I think we need to do and here's why. We see the difference, don't we? All right? Other comments, other points? I want to make some emphasis again here about the fact that when he came into town, that he stayed there for 3 days. And I think I've said, I've read this differently as I looked at it this week, in chapter 2, verse 11, I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. And I keep wanting to say he spent 3 nights going around the city when he first got there to investigate. No, first he spent 3 days in the city before he even went out looking. You know, there was a time just of quiet. He didn't blow into town, but there was some time of reflection, which would be pretty typical of what we've seen of Nehemiah so far, isn't it? Where there's some time of reflection. I mean, this is kind of an important point to me. That when there is a major task or a major decision to be made, having some time to think about it, some time of reflection. And it just seems that in our day, everything happens so fast and decisions have to be made so fast that you don't really have time to think about it. And that's not the impression that I get with Nehemiah. You know, many years, it seems like 100 years ago, when I had black hair and I couldn't grow a mustache. Still can't, hardly. It's all gray now, you can't even tell. I remember in General Motors, I was in a training program for a period of time, a supervisory training program. And running a department, and it was a very, very busy department. Things happened fast. You just had to make decisions fast. I've never made decisions fast. But I learned sometimes you had to make some decisions fast. And I remember this. I remember this plant superintendent coming to the department, and he never came to my department unless he was coming to see me, and it was never good. I mean, there was never pleasantries exchanged. But as he came riding up on his scooter in the plant at very fast speed, I thought, this is not good. And as he comes scooting up, he got real close in my face, and he said, I forget even what the situation was, but it was something that we had to do, and the decision had to be made. And I remember him saying, Greer, make a decision. I don't care if it's right or wrong. Just make a decision. And that was kind of the way that decisions were made sometimes. But isn't that the way things are sometimes in this life? I mean, we hurry things through. We make decisions fast, sometimes without thinking some things through real well. Not the impression that I'm getting with Nehemiah. What he was dealing with was so important, it took some time of reflection. What spiritual applications can we make? I mean, who else can we think of who would take some time to think about some things or find some time of quiet reflection? Who can you think of? Who stands out? Always interesting to me the number of times we see Jesus seeking a place of quiet where he could pray. I counted up one time, and I forget now how many times it is, number one, that Jesus prayed, and how many times he went to find a quiet place, whether it was to the mountain or somewhere where he could find quiet, and sometimes pray all night. And there's a lot to be said about that. I mean, can you find a place of quiet reflection? It's hard, isn't it? Without there being something in the background that disturbs us from being able to think some things through. But I think we see that as a pattern of those who are wise and those who know how to make reasonable decisions. Finding a place of quiet and reflection. I think Nehemiah demonstrates that as well. All right, in the bottom part of our page, page 6, Nehemiah understood that those who were down needed to be lifted up. Balanced leadership here, again, is the idea. What do we see with Nehemiah in this regard? I mean, think about what he is seeing when he comes into town. So the walls have been destroyed of the city years and years ago. They're still on the ground. And yet he sees, it appears to me, his role as a leader is one who is trying to lift some people up. Let's think about some application with this. You know, that a leader has to understand the disposition of those he hopes to lead. There has to be an understanding of the needs. Earl. Absolutely. This is a key point to me. It was not, you know, some people are masters of the obvious. I get that way sometimes. You can make a statement about something that, like, duh, everybody knows that. I mean, it's no benefit to come into town and say, you know, these walls have been crashed down like this for years. Well, yeah, we live here and we see that every day. Okay, a master of the obvious. Well, what did they not know when Nehemiah came to town? That he was there by the pleasure of God. You know, that he was there to try to effect some change, and he helped them to understand that point. And so I think that's kind of a key point. What else do you see? What else would you say with that?
Project. In other words, you're not
There's, yeah, go ahead, Neil.
Also, the amount of health problem up that keeps it that way runs interference from the local authorities try to interfere. That may make it a little bit, but it keeps it down so long.
Yes, I suspect that's right.
He came in from behind and lifted them up.
And he's going to prop them up.
And then he went to the front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because as we see, as we read on, there's going to be some other issues that they have to deal with. Those perhaps that have worked to hold them down. I mean, we've already seen Sanballat and Tobiah, you know, that have, it seems, done everything they can to kind of hold them in oppression. And Nehemiah is going to try to lead them out of that. All right? Let's make some personal application about what do we need to do to be an encouragement to brethren. I mean, what can we pull from this in a way of personal application? What must we be doing? Think of some ideas.
It's easy sometimes to become discouraged in the age that we're living in because we're seeing morality erode around us. We see a government that used to support and encourage morality is actually doing exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. And the world's changing, not for the better, mm-hmm. for the worse, and we can become discouraged from mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. It's easy to be overwhelmed by what's around us.
But what we need to do is encourage each other to remind each other that God is ultimately in control.
Yeah.
And if we do what's right, and we live the way God wants us to live, even though we're living in a wicked world, in the end, we will be preserved.
Our view of some things and our focus is going to have to be so very different than the world or what's around us. Nehemiah was able to do that. He was able to keep his eye on what was critical and help others to see that too. Neil?
Discouragement, distraction, and complacency. Mm-hmm. But we don't need to help other people, help ourselves and others as well.
That's right. Yeah, we can't become bogged down in that because we can be of no help to others if that controls us. Rick? How does this affect the church in a collective sense? And what do church leaders have to be aware of? And what do church leaders need to do to keep a focus? What would you say to that? In a collective sense, how does what's going on around us affect the church? What do church leaders need to do? Everyone can have a part in doing what is right. It's interesting in the next chapter, as we go there in just a moment, to see the involvement of so many. Everyone had a place and had a part to play, and we can see that. And leaders in the church have to help others to see that focus and to be focused on, here's what we can do. Well, what about this? Oh, well, I don't know if we can affect that, but here's what we can do. And we have to see that. Brent.
We have to put all of us have to learn our trust in God and not in men. It takes men to do God's work, but if men are looking at things from the standpoint of what's going to prevent us from doing this, we can't do that. A lot of times that's how churches just stay stagnant because we can't take on that type of project. Mm-hmm.
Paul said in Romans chapter 8, you know, that if God is for us, who can be against us? I mean, that was very much the attitude that was kind of displayed by Nehemiah. It was a contagious attitude. I mean, when he came into town, it was Nehemiah's attitude. But within a short period of time, it was the attitude of all the people. I mean, you know, someone that has a positive, encouraging type of an attitude can be contagious. Of course, a negative attitude is contagious too, but they already had a lot of that. They're trying to get over that. But a positive attitude can be contagious as well, and we see that. Let's go ahead, Les. And move forward. That's right. That's right. Good thoughts. Let's look at the next lesson here a little bit. Lesson 4, as we get into chapter 3. We're making the point here that leadership is hard. And only those who have been in leadership positions would understand that. It's always interesting that those who are not leaders of an organization or a team or whatever it is, are the ones that can always easily make criticism of those who are in leadership or decisions that are made, not maybe understanding some of the reasons why decisions are made. It works that way. It doesn't matter where it's at. It doesn't matter if it's in a work situation, on the fire department, in the community, at school. It always works just that way. To be effective in directing the course and outcome of an activity, though, there are certain characteristics or certain traits that can help one in leading. And so as we're going through Nehemiah, we're trying to pull some of those out. We're trying to see some characteristics that would be helpful to us, you know, in the home, in the work situation, and certainly in the church. I mean, for there to be a positive outcome, you know, the challenge very often is in trying to create an environment where everyone can feel needed. Everyone feels that they are of value. And it's only then that you're going to get full cooperation from everyone. Chapter 3, I think, helps us to see that. Nehemiah was able to create that kind of environment where people who evidently were not involved in anything before as far as rebuilding the city all of a sudden became very much involved. And those who were leaders in different aspects of community work or their place in the community, became leaders in rebuilding the wall. You have to wonder, well, what had been happening for the last 13 years? I mean, why had that not been going on already? And I don't know that I can answer that exactly, other than what was mentioned a while ago, there were those of opposition. And the opposition had been very effective, it seems, at being able to keep anything from happening in Jerusalem. And what's amazing is one man comes to town and affects change as far as getting some things done right here. There is a spirit of unity that becomes very strong and becomes very powerful, where everyone is working together to try to accomplish the will and the work of God. I mean, when Nehemiah came to town, you could imagine that first 3 days when he's in town, he's kind of looking the situation over. And then he goes out at night trying to get, very quietly, trying to get some more information about just how bad is this. I mean, can you imagine just walking away and saying, man, we can never get this done. I mean, this is worse than I thought. I mean, there's not a stone on top of stone. I mean, we got to start it at the very beginning. We got to move the broken stones before we can even start putting new stones in place. You can imagine just how bad the situation was and how that could affect even what you would have to say in a negative way and how you would even try to lead. So, I mean, the job was daunting, to say the least. You try to get a picture of that in your mind and understand that situation. The fact that, and we mentioned this some already, the fact that the wall had been down for such a long time says something about the present leadership that was there. That they were not able to affect any change. I mean, we've seen leadership like that. Here again, we can go through the whole gambit of, well, we've seen ineffective leadership, you know, in homes, and ineffective leadership in the church even. We've seen ineffective leadership in community, in schools, in government. How do you change that? I mean, and what's most critical to us is in our homes, how can there be good leadership provided? And in the church, how can there be effective leadership that is able to pull people together and to build unity? And when we read through chapter 3, that's what I see is happening in Jerusalem. That the attitude has in some way changed, where everybody is willing to cooperate and work together, and everybody is focused on a common cause. And here again, that to me, the common denominator of the change is Nehemiah. Now, can't take anything away from the Lord's influence on this, but it's the Lord's influence on Nehemiah. There's one man that has come to town, and there's been a great change that takes place. And so, I mean, we never need to say that one person cannot make a difference. You know, sometimes in just a really bad situation, I've heard someone say to the effect, one person can't fix this. Well, true, one person may not be able to fix this, but one person can have an influence that leads others in a direction to fix what needs to be fixed. And that's Nehemiah. And so we're looking here at this point of leadership is hard, but effective leadership can accomplish a lot, Brent. Right.
Because we're so used to things, we're just kind of walking with the fall. What I appreciate about what Nehemiah did was is that he not only went in with the attitude that he was going to do what God asked him to do, and that the goal was to please God, mm-hmm. not to please him.
Mm-hmm.
But he involved all classes. Everybody had a part, like you mentioned. And so even the person
we use the phrase sometimes, can't see the forest for the trees. And if you grew up in the forest, so to speak, whatever you see, whatever your environment is, kind of seems normal to you. And somebody else walks in and says, man, look at all these trees. I mean, it's like there were those in Jerusalem, you know, some who had come back as part of the remnant, some likely would have been born there, and all they knew was the destruction. And Nehemiah is sort of the one coming back saying, man, look at all these trees. Well, it's not that they couldn't see the walls were broken down. But nobody, it seems, had been able to come to the point of saying, here's what we need to do. And so now there's some movement that's taking place. And it's not that Nehemiah rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem by himself. In fact, that's absolutely not the point. The point is that he was able to provide some encouragement to get others involved in that. He was a motivator, is what he was. Look on the outside, you know, and that's a difficult thing in industry or in business. You know, you want to promote from within, But sometimes you really need someone outside to come in and say, have you all not noticed this right here? And a lot of times people haven't, because they've been there all the time. And the eyes from the outside come in, they see some things completely different than those who have been inside. Now, I wonder if that's a little bit of the problem in Jerusalem. And so Nehemiah is a motivator, and he's bringing a new set of eyes to the whole situation here. When we look at chapter 3, and I hope some of you have read through chapter 3, it's a really hard chapter to read through. And I'm not going to read all the way through it, just because it takes about 6 or 7 minutes just to read through the chapter because of all the names that are in there, half of which I can't say right anyway. We're going to read some, though, just to kind of get the flavor of some things that are happening. We need to understand, you know, now that he's in town, now that he's kind of said, okay, here's what we need to do, and everybody has said, all right, you know, let us build the walls. Remember the imperative there. Let us rebuild the walls. We need to notice what's happening here in the city. Chapter 3. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Haniel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zachar, son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hasaniah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Meremoth, son of Uriah, son of Hakaz, repaired the next section. Next to him, Meshullam, son of Bechiah, and son of Meshezebel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, the son of Baanaiah, also made repairs. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa. But their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. Are we getting a flavor of some things here? I mean, for years the walls have laid on the ground. And now we're finding just a variety of people who have come together to start working on the walls. You know, think about some of our points and questions here to kind of work through. I mean, there is a reason. I mean, while chapter 3 is tedious to read through, it tells us some very important things. There is a reason that Nehemiah journaled these things for us. And as difficult as it is to read through, we need to do that, because there's some important points that just come out of this. What is the significance of a list like what we find in chapter 3? Why was it written and preserved for us? What would you say?
One thing, maybe it may not be what you're thinking about, is that God is aware of what each individual person is doing in his kingdom. Mm-hmm. And it does not escape his notice.
I think there's a lot of points we can draw from this. Yeah. Nehemiah could see what's going on. We think God can't see what's going on too. He knows those who are working for his cause. What else can we see? What else would we say?
Another thing, the job didn't look so big and out of reach if they concentrated on this part.
Uh-huh. You know, it's the old, what's that old saying? You know, many hands makes a big job light, or something like that. You know, I mean, what one or two people try to work on it can just be overwhelming, you know, but when there are many hands working on the project, all of a sudden it's like, well, I can't believe we got that done already. You know, we see that aspect of it. James, do you have a point? I'm sorry. Okay. Les?
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I think about victors of the war are the ones that write the history of that war. You know, and people debate the Civil War, World War II, all these things that have come to pass. And depends on which side you're looking from, as to, like, you know, America was allied with Joseph Stalin. Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't seem hardly right. He was worse than Hitler. At least he, you know, killed more people, 20 million. But my point is that this is divine history.
Mm-hmm.
Secular history, it's really, in some ways, it's hard to know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But this is divine history that is inspired by inspired writers. And we and there's a quality to it that you know when you're reading all of these names, and this person repaired the fish gate, and this family repaired the sheep gate.
Mm-hmm.
All these very specific things, that this is real, this is what actually happened.
It's history that means something because we know where it came from. I may have told the story before. Short Mpande, a preacher in Zimbabwe, Africa. We were riding the back of a truck one day going to a place to preach, and we got talking a little bit about the Bush Wars that took place in the early 80s, which were just tragic and devastating. And he made the point, it was a very emotional kind of thing as we talked about that, his father was killed, was murdered in the Bush Wars. And he said, there's been many books written about the Bush Wars. And he says, I don't believe any of them. He says, man can write whatever he wants to write and call it history. And he became kind of emotional, speaking about this. He says, and those books are not true. I know they're not true. I was there. I lived the Bush Wars. And I kind of sat there for a word, just bouncing down the road in the back of this buggy, you know, and he kind of looked out the window and he was just deep in thought. I didn't say a thing. What could I say? And he looked back and he said, there is one book of history that we can trust. Just one. And it comes from God. That's just one. He was adamant. There is a reason why Nehemiah penned his journal in this way, even in the detail that he did. It's God's history of what happened. And there's a reason for us to read it and to know. Now, Lord willing, for next Sunday, we're going to take up right here. I really, really, really want you to read chapter 3 a couple or three times. Just read through it. It's hard to read through it, I know. But there's some points we have just got to pull out of this as we go forward. And Lord willing, next week we'll get to do that. If you don't have lesson 4, pick one up back there in the back. You'll need that. Thank you for your comments. Please, let's move up here. Move up to the front.